Phil Picardi here with the NPR News Update for Thursday, August 29. On the podcast, The Dream Not Quite Realized here in Minnesota. The Southwest LRT still has elected officials along the line asking a lot of questions. State Senator Julianne Ortman has designs on the U.S. Senate. And we're not seeing a lot of same-sex couples in Twin Cities television ads, but we are seeing plenty of cat videos online and at the state fair. First, Minneapolis public school buildings without air conditioning are closed today and tomorrow. After three hot days, spokesman Stan Allen says it was getting hard to maintain the safety of students and staff.
We've delivered thousands of cases of water, and we've also brought in a lot of fans and air conditioning. But at some point, we've decided that this is no longer sustainable, and we want to give our staff and students a couple of days off.
School resumes after Labor Day. Minnesota Orchestra music director Osmo Venska has eased a deadline to restart rehearsals, UNCARE reports.
In a letter in May, Venska set a September 9th deadline for a start of rehearsals for both a recording session for a new disc and to prepare for November concerts at Carnegie Hall. Calling on management and musicians to resolve the ongoing contract dispute, Venska said if the orchestra was not prepared for the Carnegie concerts, he would be forced to resign. The recording session has now been postponed until the spring, and in a written statement presented to a Minnesota Orchestra board meeting, Venska said rehearsals need to begin in the week of September 30th for the Carnegie shows. Orchestra management says for logistical reasons, this means there needs to be an agreement with musicians by September 15th. Orchestra musicians, who have been locked out since October 1st, responded if management had accepted mediator George Mitchell's proposal for playing and talking, the musicians would be back at work next week. UNCARE, Minnesota Public Radio News.
The federal government says Xcel Energy's nuclear power plant at Monticello was not adequately prepared for flooding. And the plant will be inspected again. Here's Stephanie Hemphill.
Earlier this summer, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission notified Xcel that for most of 2012, it failed to show it could protect the Monticello plant from flooding within a 12-day time frame. Xcel explained that floods generally happen slowly enough to hire contractors to build berms to help block the water. But the NRC says it still believes the lack of a plan was serious enough that the plant needs to be inspected again to make sure the company understands the root cause of the problem and to assess the safety culture at the nuclear plant. In a statement, Xcel says it annually assesses flooding potential and makes plans based on those predictions. With the materials to build a berm now on site, Xcel says the potential safety concern has been resolved. Stephanie Hemphill, Minnesota Public Radio News.
A federal magistrate is deciding what to do about the recent release of confidential documents related to a wrongful termination lawsuit against the Minnesota Senate. Tim Pugmire has more.
In a federal court hearing, attorneys for former Republican staffer Michael Broadcorp told U.S. Chief Magistrate Judge Arthur Boylan that the sealed document, which lists allegations of sexual affairs at the state capitol, was posted briefly on a court website in error. Broadcorp lost his Senate job in 2011 after the revelation of his affair with then-GOP Majority Leader Amy Koch. He claims his firing was unfair compared to others in similar circumstances. Lawyer Ed Kautzer described the posting as a mere mistake. But Senate lawyers claim the release was intentional and damaging to their defense. They want the lawsuit dismissed. Attorney Dale Nolan also wants Broadcorp to pay the legal costs related to what she described as a fiasco. Tim Pugmire, Minnesota Public Radio News.
The Minnesota tourism industry has seen moderate growth this summer, so says Dan Gunderson.
Business at Minnesota hotels and resorts is nearly back to pre-recession levels, according to Explore Minnesota Communications Manager Joan Hummel.
Hotels and motels, almost half of them reported that occupancy was higher this summer, and those reports were lower for resorts and campgrounds.
That's because the cold start to summer hurt outdoor tourism. Hummel says across the board, lodging revenue increased 8%.
The bigger picture was that this was our fourth summer of continued moderate growth in travel. So that's good news. Overall, tourism fared pretty well this summer.
Hummel says the legislature increased the marketing budget for tourism by about $5 million a year, so a bigger advertising blitz in the spring could bring more visitors to the state next summer. Dan Gunderson, Minnesota Public Radio News, Moorhead.
Minnesotans mark the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington and Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech yesterday with a march to the state capitol in St. Paul. The event celebrated the strides African Americans have made in the last half century. But Curtis Gilbert reports organizers stressed King's dream of racial equality still has not come true.
We'd like to have the children come up front and bring your signs.
About 150 people sweltered in the heat of the late summer sun to commemorate the March on Washington. They sang spirituals.
When we all get to heaven, what a glory and rejoicing that will be.
Performed hip-hop.
While taking control of these generational curses, the persons get critics nervous. They spit them like Sunday service.
But, and heard the entire I Have a Dream speech read aloud by 12-year-old Cherish Maxson of Minneapolis.
Let freedom ring from Lookout Mountain of Tennessee. Let freedom ring from every hill and molehill of Mississippi. From every mountainside, let freedom ring.
Harrison Bullard, who helped organize the march for the Service Employees International Union, acknowledged the crowd was small, but chalked it up to timing.
Today people aren't showing up because they marched all weekend. We had marches all over the city, South Minneapolis, North Minneapolis, and now St. Paul. A Wednesday, people are at work.
Bullard says 50 years after King made his famous speech, there's been progress, including a two-term black president. But the dream remains deferred. Community organizer Von Larry agrees. In fact, he argues America is regressing when it comes to racial equality.
With the disparities in our schools, with the jobs, it's starting to turn back the hands of time. It looks like it's starting to change back into the 50s and the 40s with some of these laws that are being passed.
Larry's especially troubled by laws requiring voters to present photo identification cards before they can cast their ballots. He sees those laws as discriminatory because black people are less likely to have a photo ID. Democratic Congressman Keith Ellison also opposes voter ID laws, but he told the crowd the march toward equality isn't in retreat.
Pessimism and cynicism never change the world, but creative optimists change the world.
But while Ellison rejects pessimism, he says it will take a lot of work to fully realize King's dream.
50 years from now, we want to be free, we want to be equal, we want to be paid, we want to be prosperous, we want to be healthy, we want to have a clean environment, we want to have everybody, whether you're born in America or not, to be able to immigrate freely and connect with your family, no matter where they're from. The time for justice is now. The fight must continue.
Standing behind Ellison were six children, ages 10, 11, and 12. He told them because of Martin Luther King and the civil rights movement, they'll never have to know segregation. But Ellison added that also means they have an obligation to make the world better for the next generation.
What a glory and rejoicing that will be.
Curtis Gilbert, Minnesota Public Radio News, St. Paul.
See Jesus, we will sing and shout the victory.
The Metropolitan Council released more details yesterday on two of the three remaining options for the Southwest Light Rail Transit Line. The line would run 14 miles between downtown Minneapolis and Eden Prairie and carry an estimated 30,000 riders a day. Planners focused on controversial proposals for tunnels that would run underneath a section of southwest Minneapolis. Brant Williams reports.
The Met Council has proposed three options for fitting the light rail line, existing freight rail, and bike trails through a narrow section of the Kenilworth corridor. One option involves moving the freight train tracks out of the corridor and through St. Louis Park, an option strongly opposed by many St. Louis Park residents. Or the council could choose to build either a deep or shallow tunnel, which raises another set of concerns. Jim Alexander, the council's design and engineering director for the Southwest Light Rail Project, updated members of the Corridor Management Committee, which is made up of elected officials from communities along the planned route.
A lot of this presentation is going to be centered around answering questions regarding the shallow tunnel. So I don't want to give the impression that we're moving forward with shallow tunnels at this juncture, but we're just in the answering questions mode, primarily from the city that they opposed to us.
Minneapolis city officials have raised questions about how tunnel construction might impact nearby lakes, trees, and residents. A tunnel would run between Cedar Lake and Lake of the Isles. Alexander says engineers hired by the Met Council have taken dozens of soil samples and determined that lake levels should not be affected. However, Peter Wagenius, speaking on behalf of Minneapolis Mayor R.T. Ryback, told Alexander he would feel better if the Met Council got an independent assessment.
When it comes to Lake of the Isles, when it comes to the chain of lakes in the City of Waters, there is no room for error.
Alexander told Wagenius that the Met Council is consulting with both the Minnehaha Creek Watershed District and the Department of Natural Resources on groundwater issues. The Met Council will need permits from the district and the DNR before it can begin construction. Alexander also addressed questions about flooding risks from removing groundwater from the excavation site. He says the construction would be staggered in a way to avoid pumping large amounts of groundwater at a time. However, Alexander says a shallow tunnel would have significant impact on trees located along the Kenilworth corridor. He says about 1,000 trees would have to be removed to accommodate the tunnel, which is actually a 20-foot deep trench with a concrete cover. Alexander says even if the freight rail is relocated, leaving just light rail trains to run above ground, the corridor would still lose about 600 trees during construction. The city's Peter Wagenius says that number is staggering. He says the tree canopy along the corridor is one of its most popular features.
If we're pursuing a relocation scenario, the city is going to make a case about, you know, aiming for preserving more if we can, particularly the fully grown trees.
The meeting was held in the St. Louis Park City Council chambers in front of a packed room of spectators. Although the Met Council is considering three options, some residents of Minneapolis and St. Louis Park see only two choices: relocate the freight trains through St. Louis Park or keep them in the Kenilworth corridor and tunnel light rail underneath. Several citizen action groups have formed to oppose both choices. The Met Council will make its choice at the end of next month. Southwest LRT is estimated to cost at least $1.3 billion and will connect to other Metro bus and rail lines.
Grant Williams in Minneapolis. We've been running a series of interviews featuring the candidates for U.S. Senate and governor who have stepped forward more than a year from the election. Today, Kathy Werzer talks with Republican State Senator Julianne Ortmann. She's a Republican, and she wants incumbent DFLer Al Franken's job.
Senator Ortmann represents the Chanhassen area. She's an attorney and former chair of the Minnesota Senate Tax Committee. Good to see you.
Good morning, Kathy.
What makes you stand out from the rest of the GOP Senate field?
Well, I think strong experience is the biggest identifier. My work at the state capitol on the tax committee was important not just for the state of Minnesota, but to understand what was happening nationally in our economy. And I've been focusing on national and state economic issues for the entire time I've been in the Senate. I'm very much a solutions-oriented person. So whether I've been in the minority or in the majority, I've actually accomplished some very important things for the members of my district, but also for the state of Minnesota, including big roads like improvements for 169 or Highway 212. I just passed this year something I'm very proud of, which is more relief and treatment, earlier treatment for folks suffering from mental illness when they are in our jails. So I've found ways to get important accomplishments through the legislature, even when I might have been serving in the minority. I think that's a distinction and an important one, because going to Washington, we'll need to get some real results, regardless of whether our next U.S. senator from Minnesota serves in the minority caucus or in the majority.
There's three other guys that are in the field. What's lacking that makes you want to jump in?
Well, for me, I looked at Al Franken. I'm running against Al Franken. I'm not in this race to run against Republicans, but I'm the best candidate to defeat Al Franken. I think that Minnesotans are looking for a serious United States senator. The joke is over. We need real leadership in Washington. And as you've said, I was the chair of our Minnesota Senate Tax Committee when we balanced our $5 billion deficit without raising taxes. It wasn't easy. It was important. And leadership made all the difference that year.
Let's talk some issues. Now, your son Raymond is in the U.S. Army.
He is, yes.
And I'm sure you've been paying attention to what's happening in Syria and in Washington over what to do. Should we take military action against Syria? And there are some who say if you have a military strike, that could pull the U.S. into Syria's civil war. What should be done?
Well, that's a pretty big question for somebody who's just joined this race. But my son, I am grateful that he is serving in the Army. He is studying Chinese, and he will be a cryptologic linguist. I'm very proud of him, and I think that we should all vote, all members of Congress should vote as if they have a son or daughter in the military, because they are all our sons and daughters. When it comes to Syria, I think we should be cautious. Very cautious, because I'm not sure we know who our friends are over there and who the enemies are, and I'm not sure we know how to distinguish them. And I would hope that before there's action taken, that we would talk to our allies and build a strong coalition with England and France and work with Russia. I think we need to know a whole lot more before we take a very decisive step forward.
there are three well-known GOP U.S. senators who wanted to fund the Affordable Care Act. Would you vote to defund it?
Well, I think the next step is to start to repeal some of those mandates. And not necessarily all at once, because there were some things about Obamacare, like the 26-year-old mandate, that's already well-established in Minnesota and elsewhere.
It seems to be pretty popular.
Yes. So, but I think the employer mandate is where we begin. Even the president and Congress knows that we can't force that employer mandate, that what's happening with that is we're losing jobs. We're going to end up with employers that are letting people go, and we're moving to a part-time economy in part because of those mandates, which say that if you have someone who's hired for more than 30 hours a week, you must provide health care. Those are having really big impacts on our economy right now. Over 75% of the jobs that were created this year were part-time only. That's really having an impact. So we do have to start to dismantle some of those mandates and go back and work it backwards.
What would you do about the immigration issue in this country?
Well, I think that the U.S. House of Representatives is probably right in saying we should take the pieces that we agree on and work on those first and pass them. But there really should not be a major change in immigration until we have a secure border. I think it's absolutely critical, or you're going to see another wave and another wave yet of illegal immigrants. We need to make sure we know that we have a secure border. And then let's start talking about how do we help those folks here have an incentive to stay here, to work hard, and an opportunity to succeed here.
So let's talk a little bit about party politics here. You faced a primary challenge last year as you ran for re-election. Are you conservative enough for the Republican Party delegates to give you the endorsement?
Kathy, I have a conservative voting record, but I'm also a thoughtful Republican. I think there were a lot of folks wondering, you know, why she isn't angry. Well, I'm not an angry conservative. I'm a thoughtful and common sense conservative. And so I think it was a question of style and not necessarily my votes. And I will continue to be thoughtful, listen. I think it's very important. As I said, I want to work bipartisan fashion. That doesn't mean that I disagree with folks in the Republican Party. It means that the approach to my work is maybe new and innovative.
Do you think a primary would be good for the Republican Party? It seems like it might be heading in that direction.
Well, I hope to earn the endorsement, and I am visiting with activists every day and building support among the base and the activists. I don't know whether there will be a primary or not, but I'm certainly not afraid of a primary.
Do you worry about the outlay of cash that's needed to run for the U.S. Senate?
Well, everybody should be wondering why it takes, you know, $10 to $20 million to run for the United States Senate. But I'm convinced, Kathy, that it takes a lot more money to buy a U.S. Senate seat than it does to earn one. And I'm in the business of earning one.
All right. Senator Julianne Ortman, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Kathy.
Werzer on Morning Edition and the NPR News Update, Minnesota's news on your schedule. Same-sex marriage is legal in Minnesota and 11 other states, but mainstream ads featuring gay couples are still few and far between. As Annie Baxter found out, a lot of companies do try to cater to LGBT customers, but it's rare for those efforts to be obvious to the general public.
Kate and Louisa are touring the Twin Cities this summer. An ad running on Metro Transit buses features the lesbian couple, who are, in real life, an actual couple. They're pictured taking a break from some house painting, and they're holding hands. The ad reads, "Healthcare that starts with Kate and Louisa."
Our brand's tagline is "Healthcare that starts with you." It's not healthcare that starts with some of you.
Dan Ness is the marketing director at YouCare. It's a nonprofit, community-based health plan that serves folks in Minnesota and Wisconsin. Ness says YouCare's transit ad campaign started running in July, and it depicts a wide variety of people besides Kate and Louisa. But Ness says it was a deliberate decision to appeal to potential customers like Kate and Louisa from the LGBT community.
We know we have members that are in the community, and we have prospects out there that we'd like to be YouCare members.
Other Minnesota companies are also courting gay customers, but their efforts tend to fly below most people's radars. Target has depicted gay couples in its wedding registry marketing for several years now. The company wouldn't say whether same-sex couples had popped up in its more mainstream ads, and they declined an interview. General Mills also didn't want to talk on tape, but the company has been engaging with gays and lesbians over breakfast. General Mills set up a blog site promoting its Lucky Charms cereal brand. The webpage abounds with gay-friendly rainbows and a photo gallery that includes photos of same-sex couples. This peppy music sets the tone. But this particular marketing campaign only launched over social media, not over a mass marketing medium like TV. A lot of companies take a similar approach.
It is lower risk.
Bob Wittick is a communications strategist. He helps Fortune 500 firms market to LGBT consumers, whose spending power, he estimates, is as much as $800 billion. But Wittick acknowledges there are costs in catering to those consumers. The group 1 Million Moms boycotted JCPenney and Urban Outfitters when those retailers featured gay couples in catalogs. Wittick says if marketers really want to speak to gay couples, they may get more bang for their advertising bucks if they place their ads in, say, the Gay Voices section of the Huffington Post. In other words, in places where gay and lesbian people hang out.
When gay couples or same-sex images are incorporated into a strategy, they're almost invariably focused in channels where there are a higher proportion of gay people seeing them.
Executives at ad agencies around the Twin Cities seem to agree that most marketing to gays and lesbians is done in this very targeted manner. And they say the legalization of same-sex marriage in Minnesota is not likely to push those efforts more mainstream yet. Mike Lascarbo is the chief executive of the ad agency Carmichael Lynch in Minneapolis. He says the world of advertising is more conservative than you might think. He says it follows culture, but typically doesn't lead it.
We love to think of ourselves as trailblazers and pioneers, but the fact is, particularly as it relates to mainstream products, our responsibility is to reflect the sensibilities of the overall population. We're trying to find mass markets for our clients' products, and we have to appeal to people across the board.
Lascarbo thinks same-sex couples will eventually appear regularly in mainstream ads. But from his perspective, that won't happen yet for years.
Annie Baxter there in Minneapolis. The Walker Art Center's Internet Cat Video Film Festival is back for another year, bigger than before. The event began last summer as a bit of an experiment to see if people would actually show up to a public exhibition of short videos they would normally watch alone on computer or smartphone. The 2012 show was a resounding success. An estimated 10,000 people gathered in Minneapolis on the lawn of the Walker for the cat videos. This year, organizers moved it to the Minnesota State Fair, and last night the audience and Matt Sepik followed.
As the sun set and the cool breeze drew in the scent of 1,000 deep fryers into the grandstand, the screens blazed forth with cat videos, and the crowd had a blast. You may have seen some of the videos already. There's the cat that squeezes through a tiny opening to get entirely inside an earthenware urn, or the feline that slides all the way down the support post of a basketball goal. There's also the keyboard cat. A few are known by name, including the now famous black and white cat, Henri Le Chat Noir. More brie than cheese curd, his existential angst has become the subject of several short black and white films narrated naturally in French. The human behind Henri is Will Braden of Seattle, the winner of the Walker's 2012 Festival Golden Kitty Award. To give you an idea of just how big this whole thing has become, Braden says in the year since walking away with the cat video version of the Oscar, he's been able to quit his day job and live off Henri's largesse.
My business cards literally say I make cat video. I'm full-time in the Henri and other pet video business at the moment. Henri has a store online, Henri has a book out now, and so from all these things sort of collectively together, it's enough to make a living.
Organizers of last year's festival were a bit concerned that people might view the event with derision or irony, but festival juror Jillian Steinhauer says that never happened, and it's just not possible.
There's a lot of, like, ironic enjoyment of stuff and, like, sort of distancing effect that happens. And I think you can't be ironic about cat videos. It's totally in earnest, right? Because they're so ridiculous. So there's something nice and refreshing about that.
From the millions of hits some cat videos get, it's obvious they've been popular since the dawn of YouTube and cell phone video cameras. But are they art? Festival organizer Scott Stulen of the Walker Art Center says that's a question he gets a lot.
My stock answer, which I've maybe said too much now, is just like, I don't care. But but maybe more truthful answer is I think some are and some aren't, like everything.
But if you insist on a higher-minded artistic message from this cat video film festival, Stulen says it is something of a commentary on the loneliness of our plugged-in society.
we feel like even more connected by the technology, but in some ways we feel more distant from one another. I think that's that kind of interesting dichotomy. And with this festival, it's kind of flipping it back. So we're showing videos that people have seen many, many times, but they've seen them alone on their phone. And instead, now we're taking it and they're sharing this and seeing this more the collective environment where they feel like we really are sharing this experience together, and that's why it's different.
That aspect of it was especially important to Cinnamon Whaley of Minneapolis. Whaley came with her cat-loving grandmother, who does not have internet at home.
Being with my grandmother and watching her reaction to these is so much more fun than seeing the girls in the office. And the people who don't get to witness this every day, I think that is more special than simply getting it off the internet. It's getting it to the people who don't get it every day.
The Internet Cat Video Film Festival has become so popular, the Walker is helping to stage similar events around the world. Next month, it'll be in San Francisco, Grand Rapids, Michigan, and Northern Ireland. Matt Sepik, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Kitties on Film and Digital Audio here on the NPR News Update. I'm Phil Picardi. Thanks for listening today. I'll have Friday news on your schedule tomorrow.